Our next, oh my goodness. You're ready, but I wasn't. Our next reading will be Wednesday night, March 9th. We have visiting poet Stephen Dobbins. And we'll be back in our regular place in the Modern Languages Auditorium for that reading. Next Thursday at 4:30 is the deadline for submissions to this year's poetry contest. And I brought some rules and entry blanks with me. I'll have them on the refreshment table after Mr. Marion's reading. We'll have our refreshments right in the back of the auditorium tonight. Richard Marius comes to us from Harvard University. He'll be speaking in the morning. University's Conference on Articulation, which is sponsored by the Composition Program. And his address, I believe, is open to everyone. That will be at 9 o'clock in the Union Club of the Student Union. Richard Marius has published two novels, The Coming of Rain and Bound for the Promised Land, a biographical study of Martin Luther, called Luther. And his next book will be a biographical study of Sir Thomas More. Very happy to have him with us tonight, Richard Marius.
Well, I really appreciate being here. I've had a wonderful time. It's been raining up in Boston. It's so nice to come to Arizona. I have had a wonderful time. I am not going to try to explain very much about what I'm going to read to you, novel that I've worked on. I actually put it up a couple of years ago after getting about 700 pages into the first draft. And I finished my biography of Thomas More, which I just got done in the autumn. And I started back through this doing something for the first time that I've ever tried to do it in writing fiction, to write in the first person, which I find very difficult, but it also has become a very different experience for me in that as I write in the first person, it seems sometimes almost as these things really, really happen to me. The conceit of the book, if you can call it that, is a man sitting in the kitchen of a farmhouse in Tennessee night after night in the summer of 1941, recalling night after night his life since he arrived in East Tennessee. The genesis of the book comes from an afternoon almost exactly 10 years ago when I'm sitting out in our front yard with my father, shortly after, a few months after the death of my mother. And my father was born in Smyrna in Asia Minor, but for reasons that are too complicated, I suppose, to explain here, grew up in Belgium. And in the summer of 1914, joined the Belgian army and was severely wounded by shell bursts before Antwerp, was pulled out by a British Yorkshire rifle stretcher bearer group and taken to London, where he spent 3 years in the hospital. And came to America in 1917 to work for Southern Railway because he met a man in London when he was convalescing before he was discharged from the Belgian army, who gave him a job, first of all, in Birmingham, Alabama. And then later he moved up to the little town near where I grew up, called Lenoir, Tennessee, which is the Bourbonville of my books. I was sitting out in the yard with my father, and something came up, I don't remember what, and he said something about something being the color of German field gray, and I was struck by that, and I said to him, suddenly, it's funny, we never talked much about this, he never has talked about the war, but I said to him, how close were you to the Germans at any one point? And he said, oh, about from here to the vineyard, which was about as far as from here to the back of this room. And I suddenly began, I don't know why I was so late in realizing all this, because I did grow up with him, but I said, do you know that you ever killed a man? And he burst into tears and said, God has forgiven me for that. We sat and talked that afternoon, one of the relatively few times we talked about his experience in the war. And so I thought about that. I published Bound for the Promised Land. I was working on that at the time. We had that conversation. But in some sense, this is a kind of fictional telling of his story, and it is fictional. It's not quite the same. He did tell me at one time, sometime after that, that he had dreamed for 20 years of being under shell fire, and that he would have terrible headaches for days at a time after these dreams. And I remember, of course, as I was a child, that he would have terrible headaches. And we had a little place out in the woods behind our place, which we called and still call the playhouse. And when my father was knocked down with one of these headaches, we would have to go out there and play, because he couldn't stand for any of us to be around the house. So this is a fictional telling of that story, and I guess that's all of it I need to explain, because forgetting it, I won't get anything read. But anyway, it goes, I'm going to just take you through the first part of the story, which is the Pinkerton part of the story. And I did work for a while. My father worked in this foundry, and I worked in it for a while. And it was a very important experience in my life. And I'm going to try to skip through here and just read you the part of the Pinkerton story. And the part of Mr. Pinkerton is that he comes to believe that he is cursed by God for bringing black people to Bourbonville. I apologize for using from time to time the word nigger in this manuscript. And I don't apologize because of the necessity of trying to recapture speech, as people in the South did indeed speak at this time. But I apologize for that part of American history that has given us that, that is now necessary for writers who are trying to write realistically about their own times to use. I am not sure why I sit writing these lines in a sleeping house. Partly I beguile the night hours waiting for sleep. I have been an insomniac since that last war, and my wife goes to bed promptly at 9. My sons go to bed early too, for they are young and they need their sleep. I seem to be blessed or cursed with less need for sleep than most people feel. So I sit here at a kitchen table looking down over the darkened hillside pasture and across the lower field where the hay grows in this hot July, and beyond it to the highway to Nashville, where the lights of cars blaze occasionally through the dark, and where the large trucks pass two mysterious journeys, I think, at this late hour when the world should be fast asleep. But then I suppose my solitary light, gleaming here on the side of this low ridge, must seem mysterious to them too, and I reach out without touching across this dark land. I have decided to write about my ghosts. I do not know for whom. Perhaps for my younger sons, who may come on these pages when they are older and when I'm dead and waiting for the resurrection in the churchyard on the hill, so far from where I once supposed I would await that improbable event. I wish they could understand some things. The oldest will never understand anything. But it seems that if a father has 3 sons, at least 2 of them should know something about him. Something of a life that he can never tell them, because they would interrupt, or they would not believe, or they might look on me with that pained embarrassment and incredulity that I can scarcely bear to imagine, and I could not make myself see it. So I explain myself to them here, speaking in a quiet world where I am master of the page, and the page accepts what I say, the world in my little kitchen with the windows open on 2 hours before midnight on a hot summer evening. But I suppose, too, that I regean for Bernal. They have been gone now for years. For a very long time after they disappeared, I expected them to return. I would be standing in the doorway to the barn when the men had finished throwing the new hay into the loft, the barn fragrant with the sweet, strong smell, the myriad fireflies flitting in the soft white mist rising from the freshly mown meadow, the moon high and turning white with the deepening night, and I would expect Guy's soft laughter behind me and Bernal's murmur of friendly reproach at him, for Bernal always thought that Guy's laughter had a mock hidden in it, and he thought that Guy patronized me. Guy did patronize me, but I loved him anyway. So I imagined that I would turn and look back into the gloom of the barn's interior and see Guy standing there in a luminescent green velvet waistcoat with his black tails and the bright red cravat that he wore to mass on the morning after he had danced all night. That was 1912, and we were about to graduate from the Lycée in Ghent and to enroll in the university. So in the barn, he would laugh in his delight at my surprise, and Bernal would advance, smiling with him, and the three of us would stand, talking with our old animation and delight. I suppose that if they came to me anywhere, it would be in the barn. It was a fine, private place in the evening, and they had both been there when I built it, the two of them lounging in the shade, Guy grinning in what was almost a smirk, while Jim Ed and I sweated and grunted, and old Mr. Munford hammered nails with other nails in his mouth. But after they left me that last time, they never came again, and now I know that they are gone from me forever. So I write to keep something of them here in the world of the living. Perhaps, too, I write to prove to myself that I was not insane, as if it did not matter. I heard on the news tonight that Hitler's amazing advance into Russia goes on. His generals are predicting that the Red Army will dissolve in 6 weeks. Does Palmyra have a son in that army that now plunges across those vast steppes I shall never know? An irony, if we had married, I would not be here, and my sons would not be safely asleep upstairs in their little rooms, and in truth, they would never have been born. Jimbo would never have been born. How very strange it all seems. God protect Palmyra's son or sons, even in that terrible cause. But of course, I do not believe in God. I also do not believe in the ghosts. Now, almost three decades after I began speaking with them, I can understand well enough how it all came about, just as we can understand sometimes how we had a certain dream. I knew they were dead, and I was alive, barely alive, but alive, in London, Chelsea, the Royal Hospital, in a long ward where the critically wounded lay close together in narrow beds beneath the high old windows designed by Sir Christopher Wren. I did not know how they had died. I had witnessed the death of each of them, but when my mind tried to call up the scenes again, it stopped and could not produce the info. It was very much the same as my more recent difficulty with some names. I find that if I have not thought of someone in a long while, I often cannot produce his name when some chance brings him to mind. I can remember his face and dozens of things about him, and should he be present, I can inquire about his mother, or his wretched back, or his liking for the city where he now resides, which I can flawlessly name. But I cannot name him. My difficulties with the deaths of Guy and Bernal were much more serious than the inability to recall a name. I remembered them alive, so wonderfully and exuberantly alive. And I could recall 1,000 or perhaps 10,000 things about them and about our happiness together. I could also recall waking in the hospital train and its long, slow way up to London, feeling the weight of the headache that was unlike any pain I had ever endured in my life, a pain that made my bones shriek for the consolation of death, and knowing beyond that pain or beneath it, the Bernal were dead. But I could not recall how they died. My mind stalled before an opaque wall just higher than what I could see over, and I could not penetrate the wall to recall the horror, not then, not even when I came to Bourbonville. So I lay in my bed in London, my head, my chest, and my legs wrapped in bandages that covered the wounds left by the exploding German shell before Antwerp. My head hurt in a way that I can never describe, for there is no metaphor that can convey a pain to those who have not had it. Underneath the pain was guilt. I was alive, and they were dead. The guilt was as bad to my soul as the headache was to my body. It was a pain beyond the telling, a weight beyond the bearing. I wanted to die, but I was too sunk in apathy to make any contribution towards my fervent desire. I could only lie there and wait for something, I knew not what. The nights were worse than the days. One eye was left outside the bandages, and I could see the tiny electric light gleaming at the nurse's station at the end of the long room. It was a funereal light, and around it, awful beings hung in the air. When I shut my eyes, the outside world still came in. I could hear the low blast from the horns of boats in the Thames, and from somewhere far in the distance, perhaps from Victoria Station, came the rumble of trains and the high-pitched shriek of their whistles, sound of a city at night working at war. At this moment, there is not a sound in all the world except the insects and the trees that fill the woods not 50 feet from my kitchen window to the west. Still, when I shut my eyes in London, most of the world was closed out, and at some moment when the air was crisp with autumn, I began talking to Guy and Bernal. Bernal was devout, so devout that he always made me uncomfortable and amused Guy. At least Guy pretended to be amused, but I thought that he too was uncomfortable. Bernal prayed in the Cathedral of Saint-Bavon in Ghent, where we all were before the war. He kneeled in the chapel before the vanishing of the Adoration of the Mystic Lamb, looking up at the green field and the prophets and the saints and at the white lamb, and he moved his lips in prayer, and the tears ran down his cheeks. I came upon him there once, and I was as embarrassed as I might have been if I had seen him copulating with a whore or defecating in the WC. Guy was an atheist. At least Guy said he was an atheist. He also said he was a socialist. He wondered how anyone could prove the existence of God, or that anyone should take the trouble to go to the embarrassment of prayer. Bernal said, "You do not prove that God is before you pray. You pray and God is there." That is how I felt about talking to Bernal and Guy. If I spoke, they must be there. It was entirely a fantasy. I knew it was a fantasy while I was doing it, but it was a comfort. While he was dying, poor, fat, miserable Dale Farmer confessed to me that he had had fantasies about baseball playing long, long after he had passed the age when he could possibly have played. He was almost out of his mind from the fear of death, and he imagined that I was his friend, though I did not like him very much, so he confided in me. He told me that he imagined himself pitching in the World Series against the New York Yankees, and one by one the great men came to bat against him, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Tony Lazzari, and all the rest, and he struck them all out. Again and again, in his fantasies, he told me, he pitched the first perfect game in the World Series history, and in the seventh game, he won the series with a home run in the last half of the ninth. He said that sometimes when he was depressed and could not sleep, he stood out there on the diamond in this fantasy world of his and pitched the baseball. He could feel himself doing it, and as thousands and thousands applauded, he thrilled inside, and it helped him forget that he had lost all his money. So it was with me and with Guy and Bernal. We had been together every day for almost 3 years. I knew every intonation of their voices. I knew their minds, how they would respond to whatever I said. What was wrong with talking about them, with them? Bernal did not believe in such things, not because they were impossible, but because they were immoral and ungodly. In the retreat of 1914, when we came on the palm reader in the village where every house had been leveled by shellfire, and she was there, sitting in the midst of the ruins at a little polished wooden table, as though she had been seated in an office, and out of the same madness that afflicted her, afflicted our world, Guy and I insisted that we have our fortunes told. "You cannot do this," Bernal said, horrified. "You cannot meddle with the secrets of God. You cannot practice necromancy. Remember the Witch of Endor." But Guy and I laughed at him. Bernal thought that if we knew the future, it was because the spirits of the dead spoke to us. And he thought that God had cursed witchcraft. So Guy and I had our fortunes told. And she told me that I would journey across the sea and marry a blonde woman. Bernal said that we were cursed after that, and perhaps we were. But I wander from my point. My point is that I did not believe in truth. I spoke to Guy and Bernal. Something solid and unyielding in the back of my mind always told me that our conversations were entirely made up and that my talking to them was no different from a foolish desire that made Petrarch write letters to Cicero or to Livy. Talk to them in those deep night hours when the shoes of the nurses swished along the smooth floors between the narrow white beds where the wounded slept and often died. I whispered to them so softly that no one could hear me. They whispered back with equal softness so that their voices were like distant sounds in a gentle wind. One night when it rained often in London, I was whispering to them and I pretended that I could hear their voices in the rain falling high above and running into the guttering and passing down somewhere to the ground. It was like an optical illusion, only this was an illusion of the ears, an auditory illusion. Sometimes I could hear their voices and sometimes the deep sound was the distant running of water in the copper gutters, their voices, water. Their voices, water, first one, then the other. I amused myself talking to them when the sound was the curious mingling of their voices, as though they were very far away, perhaps calling to me from some deep valley cleft in granite. And when the sound became water again, I ceased and waited serenely, knowing the voices would come back as they did. And then that night, I heard the voices and the water together. I mean, I heard the clear, distinct sound of the words, the voices, and the clear, distinct sound of the water running in the background. At first, I did not quite understand what I was hearing, but it came to me, voices and water together. Far off, I heard clocks striking 2 in the morning, solemn heavy ringing of two notes repeated again and again across the city. And then the voices were much nearer, and I heard Guy's voice and his laugh, his unmistakable laugh. I opened my eyes, and they were there in the deep gloom of the hospital ward. Burl was wearing his uniform. He was always irritated by it because it fit him so poorly, and he was vain about his clothes. The collar of his shirt was too large for him, and his tunic was far too tight. But Guy was in his green velvet waistcoat and his black tails, and from one hand he dangled a cigarette. I could not smell the smoke, but I could see it. I want to affirm here and now that I did not believe the two of them were real. I never truly believed it. I saw them, but I did not believe they were ghosts. I'm going to skip now to the third night, when my narrator comes to Bourbonville. The third night, I am my own Scheherazade, saving my life from myself, or perhaps from the dark powers, by telling a tale each evening. I have slept well the last two nights, awakening with astonishment in my little room each morning to see the dawn lying in the green grass, slipping itself under the maple trees that are large now, so large that I scarcely can believe they were little shoots of trees when Jim Ed and I planted them. I have been astonished because I have slept the night through, not waking as I usually do to listen to the silence. I have never accomplished very much. With these pages, I feel that I am creating a monument. Yet the pages are more difficult than I say would be when I started. There are so many connections that I cannot possibly record them all. And in failing to mention them, I feel the incompleteness of my design. I cannot, for example, sort out everything I know about that first meeting with Moreland Pinkerton and separate the meeting itself with everything Mr. Pinkerton told me about it and about himself afterwards. Mr. Pinkerton believed that he had a destiny, a calling to be something that the world would hear about and revere. Afterwards, I supposed he did have a destiny, a fate, that was important enough, although it was different from anything he expected. He wanted to tell his story to anyone who would listen. I believe he supposed that when greatness did come to him, the world would rapaciously devour any details it might obtain about him, and he wanted to leave his story with as many people as possible so that they might testify about it and get it right. I was silent in those days, as I still am silent, and people spoke to me because I did not interrupt them. Mr. Pinkerton used to come by the laboratory in the mornings and watch me with my bottles, my tables, my kins, my scales, and he would talk. He did not require me to answer him. He assumed that my silence meant that I was absorbed in what he told me. He told me the same stories over and over, taking a delight in them, I suppose, because in the telling he seemed to purge himself of some horror that merely thinking about them caused to grow inside him. I put the story together as from a mosaic of all his stories, and I offer it now as his monument. People in Bourbon County still execrate him. I sometimes execrate him myself, but he is worthy of a monument. Marlon Pinkerton served the Dixie Railroad as general manager for the Bourbonville car shops. One of the colonial officers, he told me, with affable bitterness, comparing himself to his superiors on the line, urbane men who strutted about in unbearable self-satisfaction, dressed in black vested suits with gold watch chains stretched across their prosperous bellies, men who rolled down from Washington in their palace cars to inspect his operation so they could write reports on creamy paper and fill those reports in copperplate hand with their own superiors, the moguls who ruled the empire of speed from their headquarters in Washington City. These inspectors had their magnificent mahogany paneled railroad cars backed onto a siding within the grounds of the car shops. They trooped down to the main office, a square frame building painted bright yellow and located in the great oval between the wheel foundry and the brass foundry, and they consulted the blue line ledgers with the officious care of sorcerers checking up on the enchantments practiced by their apprentices. They received as their due the twittering deference paid them by their underlings, and they smiled with cold sunniness on Moreland Pinkerton, who was not one of their kind. They murmured to each other, taking no one else into their confidence, certainly not divulging their collective wisdom to Moreland Pinkerton. They marched in lockstep like a squad of Marines out into the shops to look at things. Here, amid the roar and the din of the foundry, watched by every eye, They drew conspicuously apart and consulted with one another. Sometimes they drew black leather notebooks, expensively small and stamped in gold, from inside pockets of their coats, and they wrote things down. On occasion, they stood in a row to watch some process, giving to uneasy workmen an impression of buzzards lined on a fence and studying something appetizingly dead. They marched through the steel foundry, the brass foundry, the pattern shop, the machine shop, and they stood savoring almost in spite of themselves the wood-sweet smell of the long shed where carpenters hammered boxcars together from oak and pine. The carpenters were a caste. They looked much alike, long, narrow faces, high cheekbones, big hands, sharp eyes, almost invariably blue. They were quietly diffident because they felt superior to other men and could afford to be unassuming in the presence of their inferiors. They smelled of tobacco and sweat and clean wood dust. Some of them had been there since the foundry rose out of what had been a swamp. A very young Moreland Pinkerton had coaxed them out of the country, out of doing first one job and then another, out of penurious independence, and he put them to work for dependable cash money, paid every other Saturday morning in small sealed brown envelopes, stamped with the bent DR of the Dixie Railroad itself. "Look at them," he said sometimes to me when they lined up at the pay windows. "They're mine. If it wasn't for me, they'd be dirt. They'd have themselves a dime every other week." He believed that he had brought progress to the county, and the people did not appreciate what he had done. "When I'm dead, they'll understand," he said grimly. "Nobody appreciated Abe Lincoln until that actor son of a bitch shot him." The company men who came down on their mysterious inspection tours believed themselves to be superior beings, required, like medieval lords, to make a grand show among the peasants. They were condescending in the belief that their need was so clearly recognized that their visits would be received as a great benefit to be spoken of reverently around humble supper tables. They spoke with too much admiration to the carpenters, who held them in silent contempt because these nobles had soft hands. On Broadway and Bourbonville, when they walked to the square to exercise their legs, they tipped their hats to the ladies. They admired with a little too much zest the beautiful rural surroundings of salubrious Bourbonville. They spoke too warmly of the healthful air of a country town. With a little too much sentiment, they praised the neighborliness and serenity of this beautiful place. Among themselves, they laughed loudly, boon companions who had long shared private jokes. They smoked strong cigars at night in their gleaming palace cars, attended by a silent Negro porter. In stiff, starched twilight, they drank bonded whiskey and ignored prohibition in Tennessee. They invited Moreland Pinkerton to these evenings, and he came with a face prepared to marvel, a soul prepared to admire and laugh at their jokes, flatter them for anything they said or did. Once they invited me, but I was bad company, and they did not ask me again. They took off their coats and flung them carelessly on fancy oak coat trees. They exposed their suspenders. They pulled the heavy velvet drapes, green and white for the colors of the railroad, and they played poker until far into the night at a quarter an ante. "I'll call that bet and raise you 2 bits. I remember the words spoken around fat cigars in a kind of choking jocularity. They treated Moreland Pinkerton just the way they treated Bourbonville. They made a little too much of him. They praised him for qualities he did not have. They flattered him for the military precision with which he ran the foundry. And always they left him there in Bourbonville, a remote and desolate little town that he had created and now despised. And when the train pulled off with a palace car at the back, Moreland Pinkerton stood waving at them until the red light on the rear platform had disappeared around the bend by the brick cotton mill, and he hated them with a passion that, had it been fire, would have incinerated their bones. I stood by him on the side of the railroad sometimes as their train pulled away, and I saw an expression on his face that would have been fitting for a damned soul in the torments of hell." Moreland Pinkerton had built the car shops. "If it hadn't been for me, this place would still be a swamp, and Bourbonville would still be a village snoring in the sun," he told me. I suppose he was right. He had been young and strong then, so handsome he was almost beautiful. When he was only 17 in Virginia, one of his teachers told him in a rush of pure feeling, "Moreland, I hope I live to see you famous. I want the world to know I was your teacher." He looked like a man born to be famous. He had a rugged, square face that made even married women turn discreetly to look after him in the streets. He was so handsome that people always assumed that he was thinking thoughts. He could look across his desk at you without saying a word. For such a long time, you knew he was scouring your soul. And I believe his most profound thought, one that stayed with him until his violent death, was his conviction that he was more able than anyone else he knew. He expected success and fame in the certainty that some people expect heaven and eternal bliss. He watched the trains rolling by when he was a child, and he went to work for the railroad because he loved the trains. They went places where there was more life than he had. And he supposed that if he had the right ticket, he could go to those places and drink up the life they offered, drink all of it, until his terrible thirst was quenched. He did well. And he came down on orders to Bourbonville when he was only 25 years old and found a swamp southeast of town. A swamp that had been acquired by modest and secret peculations of the railroad, the ever thrifty railroad, that bought this land through the agency of a hired, blonde, traveling evangelist named Sims. A man still remembered by some. Sims was skinny and pulsating, and he had a big voice. He told people he wanted to buy the swamp to prove the power of God. And when he prayed, God would drive the water out of the swamp as he had parted the Red Sea to show his might to Israel and Egypt. And when God had cleared the swamp, Sims vowed that he would build a tabernacle there. And he promised to bring Pentecostal holiness down and have all Bourbon County speaking in tongues. And he promised to heal the sick by the laying on of hands, and to open the eyes of the blind by spitting in them, and to make the lame walk by praising the Lord. Pinkerton told me the story, and he laughed heartily in the telling. People in Bourbon County, who owned parts of the swamp, thought Sims was crazy, and they sold him title to all of it for $5 an acre. If they had known as a railroad wanting that swamp, they'd have charged $1 an acre, Pinkerton said. They believe in the railroad. But they sold it to God for $5 an acre, the poor dumb bastards. They don't believe in God. They did sell the land. Sims had a cocaine habit. He did what the railroad paid him to do, turned over the title, and got the $5 for every acre he bought, and hit the high road, sniffing cocaine before preaching hellfire, and damnation sermons, and tattered canvas tents, where he pounded on the Bible and yowled over the book under the instant inspiration of the inspirited power. Some people in Bourbon County claim the man suffered the pangs of conscience over the way he had let the railroad use him. Perhaps that was only the wishful thinking of those who, feeling themselves cheated when they had meant to cheat instead, believed that Sims deserved to suffer for his part in deluding them. However that may have been, he decided to prove his faith to an assembly of doubters. By faith you can move mountains, according to Jesus. And a train was not nearly so big as a mountain. So the Reverend Mr. Sims decided to stop a speeding train with his bare hands. He believed that if only he committed himself to the tracks, God would vindicate him by giving him the miraculous power of Samson. But God nodded, and the followers of the Reverend Mr. Sims, as well as assorted curious and mocking onlookers who had gathered at a grade crossing in the countryside north of Knoxville, were treated to a daunting and utterly silencing demonstration of the authority of the material world over the spiritual. Pinkerton kept the clippings from the Knoxville newspapers that reported the event. Getting Sims to buy the swamp had been Pinkerton's idea. I know people, he told me. I sized Sims up in a minute. I sized this town up as soon as I saw the goddamn little shithole. By the time Sims died, Pinkerton had been in Bourbonville 6 months, building his own tabernacle, the foundry and car shops, the outpost of the Dixie Railroad, in this remote place. As I write, I hear the eerie rise and fall of a wildcat freight whistle, and the rumble of a train headed toward Chattanooga on the line 4 miles across the woods and fields of Martell. It is a ghostly sound, and I never hear a train passing, without thinking, however fleetingly, of the train that took us to the front almost 30 years ago in early August 1914. Well, Pinkerton came here and plunged out into the somnolent countryside to find men. He located men who had never worked for wages in their lives. He paid them $2 a day to break their backs with spades and shovels, with mule-powered dredges, with wheelbarrows, with axes, with logging chains. Men in Bourbon County had never heard such wages. Still, he could not drag enough of them away from plows and barns, from the familiar realm of the land and its liturgies. He raged in frustration at the obstinacy of those who refused to heed his summons, and he looked south to Sweetwater in its broad, rich valley 18 miles away, and he found black people left over from slavery and enduring life with patient dread, living in tiny clapboard shacks and toiling on land they had no thought of owning. He went down there and cajoled them and made promises, and he brought back two boxcars of healthy, strong black men, picking them out of the herd like a man buying cattle at auction. He paid them $1 a day, and they cheerfully bent their backs alongside the whites, and when the mud covered them all, as it swiftly did, God himself would have had a hard time telling the difference between those descended untainted from Noah and those afflicted with the curse of Ham. Darcy Coolidge always spoke up for Mr. Pinkerton. Part of the reason, I'm sure, was that men from the foundry stayed in her boarding house and gave her a living, but part of her talk was pure admiration. I suspected that she was more than half in love with him, but even she had her doubts about bringing black people to Bourbonville. That put the curse on him, she said. God didn't intend for the races to mix, and Mr. Pinkerton mixed them. At the time, Pinkerton was a phenomenon. An old Bourbonville stretched out for decades asleep in the sunny torpor of its riverbank and its enormous forests and the scattered, ragged fields stirred awake and looked disgruntled, as the old are when they awaken from a good sleep. And the town started up then, amazed and blinking. And there they were, white men and black men and young Moreland Pinkerton, some kind of amazing tertium quid, working harder than any of them, tireless, laughing, hollering, clapping men, white and black, on the backs, cracking obscene jokes, howling at the jokes of others, bringing out the clear, strong whiskey at just the right moment, wiping his flat, dirty hand over the spout of the jug, taking the first deep, fiery swill and passing it on, mingling his spit with theirs when the jug came back, jumping here, jumping there, pointing, beckoning, commanding, mud in his thick, blonde hair, cake on his eager face, cursing, pulling, singing, cheering, omnipresent and omnipotent as God. They dug ditches 5 feet deep. White men and black men worked with long-handled spades and water up to their waist, and they hacked the ditches, crisscrossing through the swamp, sometimes uncovering a terrified cottonmouthed snake that streaked through the water, fleeing for its life, the men roaring in pursuit and triumph, joyfully slashing the long backboned and accursed thing in two or three or four to the glory of God. And then they returned to their exuberant digging, advancing their deep ditches relentlessly to the riverbank until at last the brown water gushed down into the brown river and the river swirled it away, and land that had been a swamp for 1,000 years dried slowly in the summer sun. They chopped down the oaks and the pines, the hickory trees, the black gums and the chestnuts, and the cypresses, pushing out of places where the water had stood above the ground, and they piled the felled wood in enormous heaps 3 times the size of a mansion. And they had burnings, great celebratory burnings in the night, moved by some primitive thing that stole on them as they toiled to destroy the primitive bog, some awful piety akin to the powers of darkness, the kinship to the underworld stirred out of them by those flames in the night. You could see the glow of those fires from 10 miles away, Darcy Coolidge told me. There were people who said Mr. Pinkerton built those fires at night because he had sold his soul to the devil. Pinkerton roared with laughter at what he took to be a diabolical compliment. So filthy men, sweat-soaked and weary, looking in their mud like their original father scooped out from the clay of Eden, stood around the great pyres and looked on the burning with the voracious delight of vandals burning a city. There was a demon leaping in the fire, dancing to strange music. And they could see the dance, though their eyes could not quite make out the demon. And the dance cast a spell on them and made them forget what they had been and remember things they did not know they knew. The blacks danced with the fire, moving faster and faster in the stamping rhythms of Africa, clapping their hands together in a slow, steady crash of power, making hypnotic reverberations over the swift motions of their dancing feet. And the white men slowly began one by one to dance after them, and the whiskey jugs passed from hand to hand while the great dance went on and on, and they howled at the night, howled with the release of some terrible and glorious thing. Bourbonville lay quite awake now, awake forever from its slumber, and for miles around men came in bare feet to the windows of bedrooms and stood sniffing at the smoke from the great fires, and they saw the red burning against the night, and saw the endless fountains of sparks rushing up to die against the cold stars. And they saw the arrival of progress in their land. And in the faint, wild cries of shouting men carried on the night air and made inhuman by distance, they heard also something remote and savage from an age before progress began. I was writing of how the foundry was built and of Moreland Pinkerton's great work. The buildings went up as the summer swelled and burst and declined into a brisk autumn. It was 1890, and Moreland Pinkerton was everywhere, seeing if lines were plumb and corners square and concrete firm. He inspected beams and rivets. He peered at levels and perused blueprints, and sometimes out of simple, exuberant delight, he plucked the hammer out of a hand of some speechless carpenter and drove a nail expertly home and handed the hammer back and strode on grinning, swaggering, his proud head cocked back like the hammer of a revolver ready to fire, leaving the carpenter slowly smiling and looking after him and thinking that Moreland Pinkerton was a star fallen to earth. "We loved him," Mr. Munford told me years later as the big tears came into an old man's eyes. "That's the fact of it. We love the goddamn mean son of a bitch. And the blacks, the color, the Negroes, the niggers, whatever they should be called, at first they camped in tents on the low hill south of town, squatted on eroded red land overgrown with brambles and piney woods, land that the Reverend Mr. Sims had bought for the railroad exceeding his commission, the railroad not caring, and Sims making $5 more an acre for every morsel of worthless real estate he could buy. The blacks brought up their women and their children from Sweetwater, and they sat at night in the steaming dark of summer in eastern Tennessee, and they smoked their pipes, and they talked in their murmur deliberately in an offensive way as if they feared to have careless speech drift into the white man's town where it could cause trouble. Sometimes Moreland Pinkerton came walking up among them like some spirit of the dark. He squatted by them on the ground or else sat on one of the rough benches they had hammered together from scrap. He leaned back and smoked cigars and told stories, and he listened to their tales, and they laughed. They all laughed. He looked in on their children when they had fever, and he complimented their women on flowery dresses sewn up from feed sacks. The women bent their heads and looked at the ground and giggled with pleasure. He ate cake baked in clay ovens with molasses to sweeten it, cake that was heavy and soggy, and he pronounced it the best cake he had ever eaten, and he wrote the recipe down on the back of a brown paper bag to send off to his mother in Virginia. Sometimes he'd slip a quarter to somebody with a bad tooth and direct him to a white farmer who would, for that silver quarter, yank a bad tooth out of a black head. I heard again and again the story of the hot afternoon when a stupid white man named Reed, greasy and hostile, squint-eyed, with a round bald head and a belly that fell over his thick leather belt, slapped a black water boy who did not have water in his bucket when Reed was thirsty. Someone else had drained the last drop, and the boy was starting back to the well for more when Reed wanted a drink, and not able to get it, slapped the child, and when the child cried, he was about 13, Reed pulled out a little blue pistol and threatened to shoot his head off just so there'd be, so Reed said, one less nigger in the world to fuck white girls. Moreland Pinkerton came on the scene out of some sure instinct for danger, and he jumped on Reed like a tiger out of a tree. He slapped the pistol out of his hand and sent it flying off into the muck, and almost with the same smooth, hard motion, he slapped Reed flat across the mouth with an open hand, brought the hand back again across Reed's eyes, forward again across the mouth, repeating the motion so fast that it sounded like somebody hammering nails. And when Reed brought his hands up dumbly to cover his face, Pinkerton stepped back and delivered a hard swinging kick right up into Reed's testicles. People told me then that Reed just dropped on his hands and showed a bloody face, petrified in amazement, then pitched forward into the mud, holding his crotch with both hands, and lay on his side, and incredulous. And then Pinkerton grabbed his head and picked it up, the body falling. He spat in Reed's face and told him that if he, Moreland J. Pinkerton of the Dixie Railroad, should see Mr. Reed 5 minutes hence, that he would personally twist a penknife up Mr. Reed's prick, and with that he hollered for a knife, and maybe 24 were instantly produced out of denim pockets. Mr. Reed thereupon discovered an energy and a purpose he had previously supposed departed from him forever, and it is said that he removed himself with such speed that he left a wake in the swamp. And Pinkerton turned fiercely around to the water boy and to the water boy's father and shouted, "You may be niggers, but by God, you're my niggers." As I say, I heard the story many times from both blacks and whites, and it spread at the time like a hurricane. White Bourbonvillians had one sure article, a social faith, and that was that blacks should be kept in their place. Many people in the town watched a stranger changing their ways and muttered among them. Pinkerton turned fiercely around to the water boy and to the water boy's father and shouted, "You may be niggers, but by God, you're my niggers." As I say, I heard the story many times from both blacks and whites, and it spread at the time like a hurricane. White Bourbonvillians had one sure article, a social faith, and that was that blacks should be kept in their place. Many people in the town watched a stranger changing their ways and muttered among themselves about the mythical days when the Klan would have settled Moreland Pinkerton fast enough. The leader of the muttering was Mr. Oswald Mahoney, keeper of a hardware store that was still here when I came to town, still presided over by Mr. Mahoney, although he was steadily losing business to Kenlaw. Mr. Mahoney was paunchy and prim, carrying himself with the stiffness of an elderly woman who has lived her life in fear that if she relaxes her vigilance for an instant, obscene little boys will look up her dress. Mr. Mahoney's long English face was as white as milk because he could not go out into the sun without raising blisters on his skin. So he ventured out only at twilight and in the dark, like a vampire bat, Virgil Weaver said. Virgil's friends laughed at the aptness of the comparison, and Virgil's friends were some of the best people in town because he was well connected through his family, but I get ahead of my story. Mr. Mahoney did represent an opinion, and some people nodded when he spoke, and the town fathers of Bourbonville passed without discussion a law forbidding any black person, man, woman, or child, to be on the streets of the little town after 6 in the evening. Mr. Mahoney put out the tail, but Pinkerton meddled with black women. Why else does he go down there at night? Hell, gives the husbands a quarter, and the husbands let him get himself a little poontang. He ain't the first. I don't reckon he'll be the last. You know niggers. A nigger would sell his own mama's cunt if he didn't ask him change for 50 cents. The tail gave Mr. Mahoney something to laugh at in his spitty way in the dark of his hardware store, where he was king of steel plows, and prince of pocket knives, and lord of barrels, and nails, and saws, and leather harness, and where he was safe in his kingdom, he supposed, from invasion, from without. Pinkerton got word of the slander, and so he told me much later on he was amused by it. He chewed tobacco then, as most men did who worked with his hands, and with his cheek packed full, he marched into the hardware store on a hot Saturday morning afternoon when idle farmers lounged in the cool dark, and Mr. Mahoney stood behind his counter, grinning his superior grin, wearing his white shirt, his black suspenders, his black necktie, and his hot black coat. People heard Pinkerton's hard boots pound across the porch planking, and they looked up and they saw him. Saw him move into that smooth, resolute inhesitancy of his. Saw him sweep to the counter, pluck Mr. Mahoney up by the lapels, yank him over the counter. Saw him begin methodically and with maximum liquidity to spit brown tobacco juice in Mr. Mahoney's face. I seen the whole thing, old Brian Ledbetter told me. Mahoney was squawking like a duck held up by the neck, and Pinkerton would chew a little, and he'd spit. I tell you, it sure did make a mess out of Mahoney. In the end, Mr. Mahoney began to cry. We just sat there, Brian Ledbetter said. Tell you the truth, I never cared for Mahoney. Not that I took Pinkerton's side, you understand. But I figured fair was fair, and Mahoney had a runny mouth. He deserved what Pinkerton done to him. When Mr. Mahoney began to cry, Pinkerton started to laugh, and he spat the whole cud of tobacco on Mr. Mahoney's face and tossed him back as if Mr. Mahoney had been no more substantial than a sack of straw. Pinkerton was on his way out when Mrs. Mahoney rushed into the hardware store from the living quarters upstairs. She was a student of Bible prophecy, and she had in her hands a large black Bible. With it, she began to beat Pinkerton over the head. Pinkerton was laughing at Mr. Mahoney, and Mrs. Mahoney and her Bible made him laugh at her, and that is the way he made his exit. Mrs. Mahoney running after him up into the air, bringing down that floppy limber book on his head with all her force until she fell away exhausted and turned back to the interior of the store and began to berate her husband for being such a worthless coward. And Pinkerton walked across the square laughing and went back to work. The blacks stayed out of the way. They worked hard all day long, and in the afternoon, when quitting time came, they walked home along the railroad tracks, keeping their eyes averted from white people, keeping their heads slightly bowed, showing by every gesture that they intended to stay in their place. They thought Pinkerton was Jesus Christ and Abraham Lincoln, Moses and Ulysses S. Grant. They built a Mount Zion Baptist Church on the highest of their low hills, and on Sundays, in this the first framed house in what Bourbonville called Bucktown, although the blacks named it Huntsville for one of their preachers, the first roof of wood shingles that grasped and held their collective religious passions and shook with the thumping and shouting of their frenzies. Their preachers prayed every Sunday for God's blessings to fall on the United States of America and on Moreland Pinkerton, and men and women in the throbbing congregation swayed and shouted, "Do it, Lord, do it." As the years passed, they named their sons after him, and at least one girl was named Morlanda. They took off their hats in his presence. He grinned at them and slapped them on the back, and they grinned slyly back at him and laughed with a quiet he-he-he when he said something funny. They were the first people in Bourbonville to call him the name he loved best, Captain. So the foundries for brass and steel and iron rose where the swamp had been. The trains heaved in with the metal parts of the furnaces and pieces on flat cars, and with bricks and gondolas. The black men and the white men toiled and groaned and cursed and put the furnaces together, and they built two tall brick chimneys that pointed to the sky like spires, and a bricklayer named Hicks died when he leaned back too far, too high, and admired his creation and lost his balance on the wooden scaffold and fell tumbling and flopping his arms like a great bird until he struck the unyielding earth. Moreland Pinkerton wept real tears, and black and white men came to the funeral and stood around the open grave and the closed coffin and sang sad songs. "He died for progress," Pinkerton said in the eulogy he spoke. "Progress takes a toll, and our dear brother Jack Hicks has paid that price for all of us. And we must remember when we enjoy the fruits of his sacrifice and taste the goodness of progress that Jack Hicks did not die in vain." The carpenters who put up the buildings became builders of boxcars. The brass foundry made journal bearings for the great steam locomotives and for the boxcars. And the steel foundry made the truck frames that held the wheels and the wooden cars. But the glory was the iron, the wheel foundry, men who had never known anything more complicated than seed time and harvest, rain and snow and drought, learned to prepare the damp sand for the molds, and how to press the oak wheel patterns into the sand, and how to tap the great furnace, and how to dance away from the great gush of the molten iron into the bull ladle, and how the colors, cherry red to incandescent, told them what the iron was and what it would be. And some of the religious men long afterwards told me that the hot iron made them think of Tubal Cain. The black men learned to be molders' helpers and to haul coke to stoke the furnace that melted the pig iron and the scrap. And they learned how to take the 850-pound gray iron wheels that the crane hauled out of the annealing pits, wheels so perfectly round that a nickel would not lie flat on the curved surface that rode the rails, and they could balance them on the flange and roll them like barrel hoops before the great drill that cut a hole in the middle where the axles would fit. And then they would roll them out into the long shed where Moreland Pinkerton's carpenters, he always called them his men, sawed and hammered and fitted wooden boxcars together. And they could, these black dancers of the wheels, work in couples and swing the wheels onto the axles and fasten them in place. And they knew what they could do, and they were proud. Moreland Pinkerton looked at all of it, saw the foundry turning like a great machine with human parts, and he was the engine that made it all run. And he believed that nothing was impossible. "I knew the railroad would call me up to Washington City in time," he told me. "I could see myself in black tie and tails, shaking hands with important people, shaking hands with the President of the United States. I thought I'd be president of the line. And if things had turned out right, hell, I might have been president of the United States." The man who spoke those words to me was soaked with whiskey, red-eyed, bewildered, and angry. And he spoke them years after the Spanish War came, when he made his one great mistake that made his dreams collapse around him and trapped him in Bourbonville for life. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.